That was Left Front leader Sergei Udaltsov as he was being hauled in for questioning after his apartment was searched by a virtual phalanx of masked police officers. A criminal case was launched against Udaltsov and two associates shortly after a Kremlin-friendly television station aired a documentary accusing them of plotting with Georgian officials to provoke mass unrest in Russia. Udaltsov and one associate were released after being questioned by agents from the investigative committee this week, but another, Left Front activist Konstantin Lebedev, will remain in detention at least until mid-December. Meanwhile, just days before the opposition is due to hold primaries to choose a new coordinating council, prosecutors launched a fraud probe against the vote's organizers, potentially derailing efforts by the regime's opponents to elect legitimate leaders. Also this week, prosecutors have asked that Mikhail Kalsenko, an army veteran detained at an anti-government demonstration on May 6th, the eve of Vladimir Putin's inauguration, be sent to a psychiatric clinic. Some 18 people remain in custody and face stiff prison sentences in connection with that demonstration. A big chill settled on Russia this week as the Kremlin ratchets up the pressure on the opposition. How far will it go, and how will society respond? Hello, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me is my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian service. Welcome, Kirill.
Hello.
Kirill, ever since last week's local and regional elections, in which United Russia performed pretty well, helped no doubt by low turnout and a healthy dose of administrative resources, the Kremlin has been on the offensive against the opposition. Are these things related, do you think, or is this just a coincidence?
It's not a coincidence. United Russia won local elections against all liberal and communist aspirations that social problems must press Russian population, especially pensioners, teachers, doctors, those who work in so-called public sector, to vote against the ruling party, if not to rise eventually. On the other hand, turnout, as you mentioned, was very slow, 11%. So we can deduce that, firstly, this 11% of people who came to the polls last Sunday is a real electoral base of Putin's regime.
Well, yeah, I guess that's one way to
yes,
look at it.
Not more, not more, 11%. Secondly, Russian liberals, leftists, communists, Western media, including both of us, Brian,
I know,
were absolutely wrong. There is no direct connection between economic situation in the country and political activity of the population.
Well, the economic crisis isn't really there yet. I mean, it's kind of a looming crisis.
Yes, but anyway, there is a great gap between the wealthy and poor and yeah. so on. And this gap is,
nobody came out to vote. And this is.
Yes, and that is.
And this
that,
was, we knew, we is, saw this coming that is, for like that a is week
we
or discu- so before.
That is we're discussing. So the outcome is Russia is not Greece, and it's not just about climate.
Well, we were predicting a hot autumn not so long ago. And what we're getting is a big chill in October.
Yes. Yes, and now it's warm in Moscow, by the way.
Warmer than in Prague, I guess.
And our task now, as you know, as co-hosts of the Power Vertical, is to introduce some new scheme of description of the situation in Russia. Or, you know, sorry for my academic jargon, some kind of other explanatory model.
Or a paradigm.
Paradigm. Oh, great, great. French,
for being
French theory. French theory, yeah, I love it. So reality is more complicated than we think. And thirdly,
As always.
And thirdly, Russian opposition failed to show itself in Russian province. That is very, very, very serious.
Not just in the Russian provinces, in Moscow, for that matter.
In some sense, local elections, even in Moscow, they are about, province as a state of mind,
right?
Yes,
right.
Of public mind. It's not about big politics. In Russian context, local elections always in Moscow.
They're about bread and butter issues. Yes. And this was where the opposition was supposed to thrive. This was
yes.
where they were.
And that is most interesting, most important, because opposition, speak with, about liberals or radical leftist groups, I think now doesn't trust everything and everyone which is or who is situated or lives outside Moscow, St. Petersburg. And that is very sad. We discussed a lot of time about the possibilities for Russian opposition to improve their performance in Russian regions.
Mm-hmm.
And opposition failed. Even when we are speaking about the so-called elections to coordinating council, even this situation proves that there is no serious efforts to include Russian regions in this Moscow web political game.
It seems to me also that the opposition kind of went to sleep, I mean, for these elections. I mean, everybody was talking about them throughout the summer, us included. And then they kind of snuck up on us and it's almost like nobody noticed and nobody cared. How do you explain that?
First of all, the Russian opposition and its leaders, they have to listen to our podcast.
Maybe they do. Who knows?
Russian opposition is divided now, really divided. And it's strange, but I think that this division between several parts of even two parts of opposition, at least, it's not just a sad for opposition itself, a sad thing. It could be a source of real strength in the future, because this division, this border between two parts of Russian opposition today, it's a real political border. It's not about personalities.
Right.
It's not about rumors, intrigues, and so on. This is about a real interest of those groups which are supporting or seems to support these political forces. So this is a division between so-called liberals and so-called leftists.
And nationalists.
And nationalists. But now nationalists, they play on the side of leftists. And that is very serious and that is very interesting. And the second question is who of what part of this divided political oppositional scene can perform or could perform successfully in Russian regions? And my answer is, leftists,
of course,
and nationalists.
And this brings us back to where we started the podcast with the case against Udaltsov. This I considered to be a rather significant event, what's going on with Sergei Udaltsov. I mean, this guy's been arrested more times than I've combed my hair in my life, I think. But and I don't have much hair anymore to comb. But there was a time when I did comb my hair. But this is different. This is different. And what strikes me about this is the Kremlin strategy up till now has been to prosecute the smaller figures, the Bolotnaya 18, for example, while just harassing and smearing the leaders, right? They don't want to create martyrs. They don't want Udaltsov to be a martyr in prison like a Khodorkovsky figure now. They don't need that. They don't want to do that with Navalny, or maybe they do, but they've been reluctant to do it up until now. But now it looks like the strategy might be changing. Or is it? How do you interpret what's going on with Udaltsov this week? I mean, one of the things I interpret is that they do feel threatened by him because of the reason you just gave. When the social reforms come, and they are coming, you will see kind of a social protest. There's little doubt about that. And Udaltsov could become a key figure in that kind of a situation. And maybe they just want to take him off the board temporarily. That's one possibility. Another is that they've really decided to just go after these guys, I think. What do you, is it one of those two, or is there something else I hadn't mentioned?
It's always hard to say about, you know, strategy. When I'm speaking about Putin's regime, we discussed a lot of time that there is no, you know, strategy, such, you know, such term in this, in the, you know, this collective Kremlin mind. This is, I think, a pragmatic and practical situation.
Mm-hmm.
They have, as it seems to them, they have an opportunity to seize Udaltsov and to lock him for such time, or to hook him for...
But they created this opportunity. Unless you believe that the Anatomy of Protest documentary that was aired on NTV, which I dubbed Siloviki TV on the blog this week, was true. That Udaltsov was really plotting with Georgian officials to overthrow the Russian state, or whatever it is they were trying to say.
The most funny thing
they manufactured this.
You, that on this video, Udaltsov is smoking all the time, but he doesn't smoke.
Really?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I didn't catch that. I didn't know he didn't smoke. I saw him smoking, but I didn't know he didn't smoke.
And
I...
he told, just he wrote it in his Twitter just the very night when this film had been aired.
Uh-huh.
So it's very funny.
But so my point is that, so they did, they manufactured this reason to seize, so they didn't take an opportunity that was presented to them. They could have had this opportunity last month, 2 months ago, 6 months ago, whenever.
I'm not sure that, you know, Kremlin or Siloviki or something like this is a kind of monolithic block. And
well,
some,
certainly not.
You know, some people from investigative committee know exactly what Arkady Mamontov, journalist and author of this documentary, is, you know, masterminding and thinking about, and so on. In some sense, I'm a follower of Leo Tolstoy, who wrote in War and Peace that there are no any, you know, great or bright generals or marshals and so on, because the events flow their own way. Things, you know, take their way. Yeah?
Yeah, that point's taken, but this whole set piece, and that's what it is, it's a set piece, looked like something that was set up. I mean, this thing aired, and this was not the first Anatomy of Protest documentary, by the way. It was the second one. This thing aired 12 days before the case against Udaltsov was launched. This looks like something that all the key players agreed on, that it's time to do this. It didn't look like somebody freelancing to me.
I think there are several parallel processes or mechanisms inside the, you know, Kremlin or regime or who else, Siloviki. One flow of events or one mechanism or whatever is a logic of, you know, producing and all these documentaries about opposition on NTV and Channel 2. Another one logic is a logic of presidential administration. Third logic is a logic of investigative committee and so on. They are parallel. Of course, they, you know, cooperate somehow, but I am not sure that the level of this cooperation is 100%. I think that each flow or each level gives some opportunities for another level to act.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they.
So you don't think this was so coordinated?
Yes, yes. I'm not. It is coordinated on some level, but this is not, you know, as like in the army or in a football team. Yeah, it's a large bureaucratic.
Yeah, no,
that
I understand. Yeah? But some things are coordinated in these large bureaucratic machines.
I think we can speak about some signals from Kremlin to someone.
Mm-hmm.
Someone on the TV channel, someone in an investigative committee, just focus on this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then the inner or insider logic of every of these bodies is just switching on, and then we see the consequences.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So in any way, it can or could take one day. In some cases, it could take, 12 days or 1 month and so on. But the most interesting thing for me is not just, speed of the reaction and so on. This is a subconscious position of or state of mind of Kremlin today. It's very interesting. More interesting, I'm sorry, Mr. Udaltsov, but it's more interesting that his individual, misfortunes and so on, arrests and so on. Because this is a very serious, not just political problem, but it's a social and psychological problem and historical problem. You know, I hate all historical comparisons and analogies and
so on. As we all do, yes.
Yes. But sometimes we can, even we ought to use them, trying to explain something, understanding that there are just tools, instruments of our thinking. Mm-hmm. And in this sense, we can compare, just in this sense, we can compare Putin of the third term with Alexander the Third. This Russian Tsar who came after the assassination of reformer Alexander the Second. And Alexander the Third ruled 13 years, as if I'm not mistaken. And the main strategy, if we're speaking about strategy, but there were no any strategy in his during his rule, but the subconscious strategy, I can describe it with one word. Or two words, ice or frozen. And we can use two metaphors which had been, used by two very important and maybe in some sense notorious Russian figures in the end of 19th century. First one is Konstantin Leontiev. He was a conservative political thinker, man of letters, novelist, well-known and so on. He, a great aesthete. By the way, he said, Russia began to rot, so it must be frozen. And the second phrase belongs to, attributes to Konstantin Pobedonostsev, who was a chief prosecutor of the Holy Synod, one of the chief figures during Alexander III and Nicholas II reign. And who was, by the way, the person from whom Leo Tolstoy just mentioned, and wrote his Karenian husband. And he was the initiator of all this, Orthodox отлучение Толстой from Orthodox Church. The words by Pobedonostsev. Russia is an icy desert where rogue hells around or rambles.
So you're saying there's a freeze now. There's a thaw, there's a chill.
This is the idea of freeze, not the freeze itself. When we just focus or analyze these words by Konstantin Leontiev, Russia began to rot. Which Russia? People? No. Economics, it was a period of a growth, a great growth of Russian economy and so on. So he is speaking, he didn't understand this, but he was speaking about a Russian state, Russian bureaucracy. And I think that when Russian bureaucrats, and Putin, he is a very good example of Russian bureaucrat, is speaking about some kind of Russia is in crisis, the ethics is awful, so we have to, reinvent some national idea and so on. He is not speaking about Russian population. He is speaking about this apparatus, the state bureaucracy and so on. And all this position to freeze something, to stop rotting, this is, kind of effort to stop of disintegration of the system as of a political system itself.
But the outward manifestation we see of that right now is a sustained attack against the opposition, that the likes of which we haven't really seen since the protests began. It's been building. But it seems to be coming to a crescendo right now. Maybe not quite a crescendo. It's still rising. But
I think it's a kind of semi-hysterical gestures to prove of Kremlin or Russian state to prove for itself that he is still existing and still strong.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the most interesting thing. We are not speaking about strategy. We are speaking about just reactions.
Mm-hmm. Now, what do you make of the fraud case that was launched against the organizers of the primaries for the coordinating council?
It will be closed, I think.
You think
just
so?
Rubbish. It's just rubbish because there's no sufficient evidence.
No, it looks pretty ridiculous, but absolutely. I'm sorry, the case against Udaltsov looks pretty ridiculous too, and that's never stopped them. The case against the case against Khodorkovsky was pretty ridiculous, and that didn't stop
them. It's about Khodorkovsky. It's about the billions of dollars
stealing from his own company. Yes.
Udaltsov is, is treating like a traitor and so on. So it's serious. It's serious in public mind.
They
public
can make it,
mind. Right. Public mind is all about money and traitors in Russia.
Right,
yeah,
right.
And all this just several rubles, which had been, as they told, stealed from MMM members.
Yeah, I know.
By the way,
I know.
So
it's from other.
You have to be an absolutely idiot to push this case to public.
So they just launched this to what? To try to discredit
just
the...
Just to trying, yes. It's a kind of a special KGB tactics to try and to try everything to find a weak point or weak. So
it was significant also that it wasn't the investigative committee that put together that case. It was the prosecutor's office.
Yeah. So what we see this autumn is a mixture of two very slow performance, very slow and very, unsuccessful performance from Russian opposition.
Mm-hmm.
Because of it is divided, it doesn't understand what to do next. It's losing the popularity because a lot of people, especially in Moscow, just sick of all this activity and so on. And at the same time, it's a very unsuccessful performance by state and Kremlin. So it's autumn of slow failure in Russia.
We thought we'd have a hot autumn,
yes.
And we're instead getting an autumn of slow failure. In a few moments, we'll shift our discussion to another item that made news this week. Vladimir Putin is known to have a vindictive streak. Does this extend to the family of an old friend and political patron? I'd like to remind you are listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me is my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian service. I'd also like to remind you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast in iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at RFERL.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical.
Anatoly Sobchak was a bright man and a very talented politician. I don't see anyone like him on our political stage today. I would have loved to see him, talk to him, seek his advice on some issues now. And it is a great pity that I do not have that possibility today.
That was Vladimir Putin speaking about his one-time political patron, Anatoly Sobchak, back in February 2010, the 10th anniversary of the former St. Petersburg mayor's death. Sobchak, who helped launch Putin's political career, died of a heart attack in February 2000 in Kaliningrad, where he was campaigning for Putin's first presidential bid. It's been long assumed that Sobchak's widow, Lyudmila Narusova, and his daughter, Ksenia, have since been beneficiaries of both protection and promotion from the Kremlin. And both did well during Putin's time in power. Narusova became a deputy in the Federation Council, and Ksenia Sobchak enjoyed a meteoric rise as a television personality, reality show host, and socialite. But ever since Ksenia Sobchak lent her star power to the opposition following last December's disputed State Duma elections, the relationship changed dramatically. Earlier this year, her apartment was searched in an early morning police raid, and she's had a harder time getting gigs on state-controlled television channels. And this week, it appeared that Putin was washing his hands of the Sobchak family entirely, with Narasova on the verge of losing her seat in the upper house of parliament. Kirill, as I've noted earlier, Putin is known to have a vindictive streak. But isn't there also something deeply symbolic about him finally turning his back, apparently, on the Sobchak family? Does this say something about Putin himself? Does this say something about where Russia is at this time?
The question is, who crossed the line? Putin, Sobchak, Ksenia Sobchak, Narusova, or just the situation changed dramatically? And I think the answer is an explanation of all the situation. Just let's discuss it point by point. First of all, Putin. Of course, we can imagine that till, you know, autumn 2012, he was very grateful to Sobchak family and to Anatoly Sobchak himself, later Anatoly Sobchak.
His affection for Anatoly Sobchak is obvious if you
and
listen to that quote that we said.
Just in the moment, he became ungrateful. Such things, they happen sometimes. They happen sometimes. But is this a case of Vladimir Putin? So we are going into a deep forest of psychology and psychoanalysis. And in this case, we have to discuss Putin himself. Second version of the answer, or variant of the answer, Sobchak, Ksenia Sobchak. I'm not sure, because Sobchak, she didn't cross line, you know, this summer or this spring, because she began her political activity just 1 year ago.
It was in December,
Yes, in December. So the reaction could be just in December from state or from Putin, could be in December 2011 or in February 2012 or in May 2012 and so on. Why just in June and then now? The third answer or variant is Narusova. But Narusova, she is not a real politician. She doesn't play such, you know, political games and so on. She is, you know, kind of passive.
Although she opposed the Kremlin in the Federation Council in some sense,
but we are not watch closely into her activity in the Russian Council of Federation. So we don't know. We really don't know what she is doing there. What she does there on every day. Basis, and the fourth version of reality is that situation changed. I think that my own answer is a mixture of the first point and the fourth point, that Putin changed somehow, and his psychology or, you know, psychotype changed or something like this, and a situation changed. So let's discuss this mixture.
There's also a symbolic element that I wanted to introduce into the mix before we get into all the psychology and psychoanalysis, is that, and I remember this, having worked in Petersburg as a journalist in the 1990s, there was a time, believe it or not, when people did view Putin as somewhat of a liberal. I remember this time. Not a liberal like Boris Nemtsov of that ilk, but somebody who I watched fight on what we would consider the more liberal side of political battles in St. Petersburg. Now, this impression of Putin, and I remember when he first was named head of the FSB, and I talked to human rights activists in Petersburg who were delighted about this.
Really?
Yes. Yes. You'd be surprised.
Maybe you met the wrong person, because I know some people.
I don't want to embarrass any of these people on the air, but trust me, I was shocked. Although at the time I wasn't shocked, although it looks shocking now looking back at this. But he was first named head of the FSB. It was seen that this was going to take the FSB in a more progressive direction. When Putin was running for president, there were liberals who did support him.
Yes, because
on economic issues
and so on, and he's still liberal in some sense.
Somewhat, But a lot of the reputation for Putin's so-called liberalism was derived from his association with Sobchak. And now the symbolic element I wanted to get back to is if he is breaking ties with the Sobchak family, which he appears to be doing, it's almost symbolic as Russia enters into this deep freeze that we were talking about in the first half of the podcast, or no?
It's interesting that all this story can be, you know, turned upside down. Putin was a close, you know, friend or follower of Sobchak, and that was a proof of his, you know, liberal intentions. Let's turn the situation.
That Sobchak was using Putin because he needed a tough KGB guy.
Yes.
Yes, there's a lot of truth to that,
I am not a supporter of conspiracy theories and so on. But now I understand something about Russian politics in the 1990s. Because huge numbers of KGB officers and agents in Russian politics in the, you know, around Yeltsin, around Sobchak, and around other so-called liberals, for me, it's more and more suspicious from year to year because I see the results of all this period of 1990s. I'm not among those who, you know, criticizing all this, you know, lichy 90s,
right,
rogue 90s, or like, you know, like chaotic.
The wild 90s.
Wild 90s, and so on. But something, retrospectively, something I began to understand. I began to understand how it worked,
because I think I'm following you, because I suspect what I think is the same thing, is that a lot of KGB officers infiltrated the administrations of these liberals or so-called liberals, and to get control of the situation, while at the same time liberals like Sobchak needed people in the KGB to fight their battles for them. So it was there was a little codependence going on there at the time.
Yes, that's what I'm speaking about.
Yeah, no, there's some truth to that. There's some truth to that.
And this, you know, throw a very unpleasant shade on Russian political process in 1990s, and I think, or I hope, the future historians will just
we'll unpack this.
Yes, unpack this. It's not, again, it's not a conspiracy theory. It's about how it worked.
No, I don't think this was centrally directed, but it turned out that there were plenty of KGB people that could, there were many potential Putins out there as the Yeltsin presidency wound down.
A
that's
lot
for sure.
Of unemployed, failed spies in the country. That is the answer. Teachers usually, or doctors, or, you know, workers usually they try to find a job to support themselves. But KGB agents, no, the psychology of KGB agents is absolutely different.
Right.
They're not trying to find, you know, some decent job.
There's no such thing as a former Czechist.
Yes, that I'm speaking about. So
okay, now we can get into the psychoanalysis.
There are two different things, psychology and psychoanalysis. They're absolutely two different methods.
Of course they are.
Yes. And if we try to apply these methods to Putin's, you know, personality and so on, we'll have two different portraits.
And we'll probably be here for a week, at least, if we try to unpack Putin's psychology.
Okay. So it's very interesting, because when we're speaking about Putin, you know, as a psychotype in psychological terms, we see that he consists of, in some sense, Shakespearean emotions and Shakespearean formats, you know, psychological formats. We just spoke about that he was grateful and then became ungrateful, like in a moment. So that is a very interesting thing. That is a thing which is well known for those who, for instance, read a lot of novels about Latin American dictators. this switch of of behavior, switch of attitude, a very fast switch, is usual for dictators who came to some level of their dictatorship, you know, of their rule. Usually, it 10th or 15th year of their rule. Usually, as a avid reader of Marquez, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and Alejo Carpenter and Vargas Llosa, and I was very fond of Latin American literature when I was in 20s or 20 between 20 and 25 years old, and I read a lot of them, and most of them I forgot, of course, Roa Bastos, a lot of them. But it's very interesting that the subject of all these novels was the same, the psychology of dictator and how it, is changing inside some context. But it's very interesting that there are different countries, Mexico, Argentina, Colombia, Cuba, and so on. But national or local contexts are different, but psychological and political context is the same. And I'm not speaking about that Russia is a new Colombia or new Cuba or new Argentina with its Peron, but we compared.
We've compared.
It's very pity, but the climate again in Russia is not is not Argentinian. Especially Cuba.
That's from somebody who's about to go to Siberia.
Some psychological and psychological-political lines of personalities are the same. And they are the same things which I see now in Putin's... maybe I'm mistaken, but I think that I...
So what are these things?
First of all, it's a very fast switch of, attitude, behavior.
Towards old friends and comrades.
Yes, and so on. First... Secondly, here usually dictators they become very lazy at the stage. They are very active in the beginning, and they are very active in the end when they reach a real end. Like Gaddafi, he was very active in the first two periods of his career. Then he just slowed down, and then in the end, all these stories with Bulgarian nurses began, and so on. It's interesting, but they dictators.
There was the Ukrainian, the history of the Ukrainian nurse as well.
The
Bulgarian nurse was a different history, actually.
Yes, first one is the history, the story of cruelty.
The second was a tabloid sensation,
and so on. We can remember a lot of such things about Gaddafi and so on. Or, for instance, when speaking about Peron, his first term, not in the 1970s beginning of, but in 1940s and 50s, he began being very active, very active. Then he slowed down till the end of 1940s. And all this, brahaha about Evita began this time. But in the end of his first period of his rule, before he was thrown away from the country, he was again, he was very active. He, prisons full of opponents of the regime and so on. So I think now Putin in his, lazy stage, psychologically.
Right.
Psychoanalytically, it's, just a tricky.
That's tricky.
Yes. I can speak about something about various traumas, as I can suppose about his person's own, but I'm not a trained psychoanalytic, so I can't speak about them professionally.
But are old friends and allies this disposable? Are they disposable for Putin? Or is he, because going back to the Sobchak family, how disposable are friends and allies then? I mean,
I think now friends are almost nothing for Putin on this stage, because now he's absolutely, I think mistakenly, absolutely, a war or proof himself. He's very stable. He thinks that he is very stable and he doesn't need any, you know, close friends, ties and so on. And I can expect several such cases as Sobchak case. Not like Ksenia Sobchak or, you know, some daughters or sons of his friends becoming opposition leaders and so on, but all the context of slowing down everything, including friendships and so on. And in this situation, everything is possible for Abramovich, for instance,
mm-hmm.
or for Timchenko.
Timchenko, well, I was just going to say, yes. Timchenko, who is rumored to be coming back to Russia.
Yes, yes, I heard about this. And for instance, Sechin. Well, now, it's a very strange story around BP and Rosneft. I'm not a trained specialist and expert in economy and so on, and finance. But the events of the last 2-3 days,
mm-hmm.
with all this strange agreement between BP, Rosneft, and then today's arrest of one of the top managers of Tenka BP, on accusation that he sold, state positions.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very, very strange. So I can expect something here. And as we told and we discussed...
You don't see Sechin in trouble.
I don't know. I don't know. But returning to some of our previous podcasts, we discussed a division inside an elite. So I can bet... if we are speaking about, hot winter 2012 or...
We didn't get the hot autumn, so maybe we'll get the hot winter.
Yes, but I'd prefer to bet on a divided elite, not to Russian opposition, and as a source of kind of uneasiness, something like this.
Yeah, I think the two things are actually related, the divided elite and the opposition.
In some sense, yes, but not... Now, I think the most important thing in this case is a situation inside the elite. But speaking in terms of future of the country, of the society and so on, of course, opposition and the process inside Russian society is much more important than any, games inside the elite and so on. But we're speaking on different levels.
Right.
Yeah?
What's going to be the catalyst for anything to get hot? Well, unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me has been my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian service. Thanks for the great discussion,
Kirill. Thank you.
I'd also like to thank our producer, Tanya Koncheva. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noize MC.